KPCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Well, let's see what we got in store for our weather over the weekend. Here with the report is Cedric Haynes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for your Friday for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at lots of sunshine returning across the area, but it's going to be cold out there with temperatures only in the mid-20s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 30s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your weekend, Saturday we'll start off with frigid temperatures. We start things off in the single digits in the Heber Valley with morning low temperatures down into the low teens in the Park City area. High temperatures as we go throughout the day get back near the freezing mark in Park City with highs in the mid-30s for the Heber Valley. As we go into your Sunday, look for temperatures well down into the low teens again to kick off your Sunday morning. With temperatures rebounding back into the low 40s in Park City, we'll see those highs in the mid-40s for the Heber Valley. Heading into next week, we'll see those temperatures basically staying on the mild side again with high pressure building in across the area. We'll see those highs in the mid-40s for us as we go into your Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We'll also see those morning low temperatures dipping down into the teens to low 20s for your Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday mornings. As far as any precipitation chances go, they're looking slim to none over the next 7 days. Really just don't have much in the way of any chances of any rain or snow expected for both the Heber Valley or the Park City area as we go throughout next week. A slight chance that we could see a backdoor cold front trying to make its way into the area as we get towards the end of next week. So that would be about next Friday into next weekend. Right now, not seeing a big chance of precipitation with that front, but it may be enough to try to knock those temperatures back down a little bit as we head into next week. But overall, looks like we're going to continue with a frigid start to the weekend, but we're going to go into next week with some mild conditions with temperatures back above average for highs. And we'll be seeing, again, those mainly dry conditions in place across the area through at least next Thursday. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Okay, let's see what these weather conditions mean for the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Drew with the Avalanche Center. Morning, Drew. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, it should be awesome out in the backcountry today. We have an overall moderate avalanche danger with areas of considerable along the higher elevations, particularly in areas that have seen the most snow and wind in the last 12 to 24 hours, and that's going to be most prevalent, I'd say, on kind of northeast to east all the way around the south face aspects, where a little bit of wind drifting occurred yesterday in the low density snow. I think probably the biggest hazard, I would say, is going to be the feeding frenzy in the backcountry, because we've been starved. The Wasatch backcountry skiers have been starved for excellent riding conditions, and that's what you're going to have today. But again, snow is going to move. There's a lot of loose snow avalanches that can be expected today in the steepest terrain, and then pockets of shallow wind slab from the wind. So again, overall moderate danger. Areas are considerable up high, but again, people need to rein it in. Don't let their emotions get in the way of their good judgment. So good safe travel protocols in the backcountry. As always, you can get more information at UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
Drew, you're going to find yourself out there this weekend?
most definitely. Again, I'm hungry and starved like everybody else, so I'll be out in the backcountry. But quick tip, folks, is if you're on slopes less steep than 30 degrees, it's going to be low risk, high reward. So take that into the weekend.
All right, Drew. Thanks, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Coming up, I'm going to get to speak with Tom Ford of the Utah ACLU about the new litigation the ACLU has filed regarding the state's book removal laws. Then Park City Council member Ed Parisian will join me with a debrief from last night's City Council meeting. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Utah State epidemiologist Dr. Alicia Nolan. Now, meanwhile, let's do a little bit of local news. Newly elected Heber City leaders were sworn into office Tuesday evening. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports they say they are grateful to serve.
Heber City Mayor Heidi Franco and Council Members Yvonne Barney and Morgan Murdoch officially began their terms Tuesday, surrounded by family and friends. Barney and Franco were each re-elected in November, and both women said they will continue to put citizens first. Standing beneath an America 250 decal celebrating the nation's history, Franco said she does not take the values of democracy for granted.
This year, I want us to rededicate and celebrate the foundational principles of our country. I am committed, and I make this commitment to all of you, to the rule of law, to popular sovereignty and majority rule.
As she begins her second term as mayor, she says she'll work daily to earn the trust of voters. Barney says she will continue to vote according to what citizens want.
I may not do this perfectly. I may make mistakes. I may also make you proud of me because that's my first attempt. I hope I will make you proud of you electing me as your city council member for another 4 years.
She says her door will always be open for conversations with locals. Morgan Murdoch is the only new face on the council. He says he's ready to jump into city government.
I've had the opportunity to meet department heads, tour our public safety and public works facilities, and get to know many city employees. I'm truly impressed by the professionalism, expertise, and dedication of the people who keep this city running every day.
He says he's thankful for Heber voters' trust and will work hard to serve locals. Heber city leaders will set their priorities for the coming year at a retreat later this month. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
This week, the Utah chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal court action challenging the state's book removal law. Here to help us understand the statute and the litigation is one of the ACLU lawyers who signed the complaint, Thomas Ford. Good morning, Tom, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Tom, when did the current, let's set the stage a little bit. When did the current iteration of the book removal law become law?
So Utah's book removal law has existed in two forms. Its original form, which was passed during the 2022 legislative session, and then its current form, which was passed during the 2024 legislative session through the HB 29 amendments. And so that version that was passed in 2024 went into effect on July 1st of that year, 2024, and it has remained in effect since then.
So what is it that made this the right time to bring the lawsuit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we obviously would have liked to challenge this lawsuit immediately from the creation of the book removal law. That said, the law has continued to progress. And it's at this point reached such a remarkable range of literature in such a large scope, reaching from St. George to Park City, from kindergarten libraries to high school libraries. And so that really motivated us to get this case into court. Additionally, you know, we wanted to bring a case that was going to succeed, you know, and that we were going to be able to get these books back on the shelves. And sometimes it takes a little bit more, a little bit longer to prepare a case that you think has a better chance of winning.
So the factual answer is really you needed to see what the impact of the law would be in fact so that when you brought the lawsuit, you would have facts to underlie a theoretical challenge.
Yeah, that's absolutely one of it. You know, as the law has continued to progress and it's continued to censor, you know, and ban constitutionally protected materials, there's obviously been a stronger claim and, more of a need to bring this lawsuit. At the same time, we also have been following precedent around the country, you know, in other cases that are challenging similar laws, mainly in Iowa and Florida, cases that were brought by Penguin Random House. And those cases, advance the same framework that we do, which is a non-public forum framework, which is different than kind of an individual book banning case in a historical sense. And that law has recently progressed and has made some, critical advancements that we wanted to take advantage of in our case.
I want to come back to that when we get more into the actual theories of the challenge. But let's sort of focus on what it is you're actually challenging. In the complaint, you make it clear that you're challenging only two parts of the law, the so-called per se ban and the statewide ban. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Let's talk, first of all, can you explain how each of those two provisions, one at a time, each of those two provisions are supposed to work?
Yeah, and so the per se ban by design sweeps up a remarkable range of literature, and a large part of that is constitutionally protected materials. And what it does is it creates a categorical, non-discretionary mandate that requires that every local education agency in the state strip their school libraries of any book that contains even a single description or depiction of sex, no matter how fleeting, no matter its context, the age of the reader, and no matter the literary, artistic, political, or scientific value of that book as a whole. And so it removes any discretion from school libraries, educators, the people that we entrust to teach our children, with the ability to make the decision about what's appropriate for their readers. And as a result, we've seen books like Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five and Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings being taken off library shelves across the state.
So,
And the second component of that is the statewide ban. And so what that does is it's pretty simple. Once three local education agencies or two local education agencies and five charter schools determine that a book constitutes objective sensitive material, determine that it violates a per se ban, it's automatically banned statewide. And so if Davis, Washington, and Granite ban a book, it's banned in Park City, it's banned in Salt Lake, and it's banned across the state. And so that, additionally has a remarkably sweeping range, and reaches from state border to state border.
And I want to go back to the per se ban for a minute. You mentioned that, you said something that was really interesting to me, which is the regardless of the age of the reader. So that I think what you're saying is that even if a school put restrictions such that only students 17 or 18 years old had access to the book, they had a restricted zone or something like that, that would still run afoul of the per se restriction.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it applies to 12th grade just as it does to kindergarten. And in a practical sense, books that were on 12th grade library shelves were never on kindergarten shelves.
Anyway.
But it just shows you how illogical this law is in terms of the scope and its coverage.
And I think one of the things you mentioned in the complaint was that the age of consent for sexual activity in Utah is 16. Is that right?
So high school students in Utah can consent to having sex with other high school students. And so they're allowed to do that under the law.
But they can't read about it.
They're not allowed to read about it. They're not allowed to learn about it. They're not allowed to discuss it in school. And what's even worse than that is that the need for this literature in Utah is urgent. According to Utah's own public health data, 15% of high school students in Utah experience sexual violence. And so these are people who aren't consenting to sex. These are people who are victims of sexual assault, unwanted violence when they're children. It's incredibly serious and traumatic events. This is something that's reflected in one of our own anonymous student plaintiffs, history. And so for people like them, to see themselves in these books, to understand that they belong, to learn how to navigate these incredibly challenging experiences that they've gone through are really critical parts of their education. And it not only does it disservice to them, it does a disservice to the state as a whole, where rates of domestic violence, and similar issues are drastically high compared to the rest of the country.
And talk a little bit more about some of the books that have actually been banned under the per se ban, and who is it that decides that something falls within the per se ban? Is that decided by the local school board?
So that's what makes the per se ban so problematic. The local school boards don't get to decide anything. It's a non-discretionary test that was created by the legislature. And so regardless of the book, regardless of the book's value, if it's been on the shelves for decades, if there's a single description or depiction of sexual conduct, that book has to be removed. And so it doesn't matter, if those books are some of the most valuable or well-respected pieces of literature, which, as we've seen, have been removed from school libraries.
And give us a couple more examples of books that have been removed under the per se provision.
Yeah, absolutely. So Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, Khalil Tosini's The Kite Runner, Alana K. Arnold's What Girls Are Made Of, Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Ellen Hopkins' Tilt, Amy Reid's Beautiful, and just recently, on January 5th, this Monday, we saw three more books banned statewide, Wicked, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and a third book.
And just so we understand mechanically, who is it that says, aha, I've looked at this, it's subject to the statewide ban?
Yeah, so each local education agency is responsible for conducting a comprehensive review of every book in their own library and making a determination if it has objective sensitive material. And so they don't have any discretion to determine what it is, but they're the ones responsible for finding it.
And as a practical matter, you mentioned that two new books happened, I think, this week. As a practical matter, once one district says, I've identified this, it falls under the statewide prescription, the other school districts will follow suit.
Yeah, so we've had three books, this past week that were banned, bringing the statewide list up to 22. And, just as you pointed out, what you see is some school districts are pursuing book removals, in their determination that they are objective sensitive material much more aggressively than others. And you see a coordinated effort, through some school districts, but also through parental rights groups, different advocacy groups that are really the driving force behind this type of censorship across the country.
So let's sort of shift to the statewide ban. How has that functioned in practice?
Yeah, and so that is a little bit more simple, you know, just in the sense of once a school district makes a determination that a book is objective sensitive material, they have to report that to the Utah State Board of Education. The Utah State Board of Education is responsible of keeping a list of all of, you know, each determination of objective sensitive material for any individual book in each district. Once that 3 LEA threshold is met, that book is pulled from every school. They send out a statewide mandate, take that book off your shelves right now.
And what's objective sensitive material? What does that mean?
So it's a, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, really explain it in a just basic sense because it's such a broad and expansive concept. And so it's a categorical ban that creates a non-discretionary bright line rule for any book that has sexual content as that is defined by the law itself. And what the law does is it incorporates 3 terms from Utah's criminal code that are used in terms of public indecency in different scenarios like that into written literature that obviously have no, you know, similar application in the way that they're presented. And additionally, the criminal laws are governed by the First Amendment requirement that if that speech, you know, that's being censured has value as a whole, it's protected by the First Amendment. And that's the same thing with school library books. And so the per se ban removes the ability for any librarian, any school district to make a determination to conduct an individual assessment of any one book and say, hey, you know, this is a book that's been on our shelves for decades. It's part of our required reading courses. We know this has a ton of value for our students. We want to keep this on the shelves. They can't do that under the law.
So this concept of sensitive material, it reminds me of my law school days 40 years ago, Potter Stewart, as I know it when I see it. So what, that feels pretty mushy as you're explaining it to me. Sensitive material, and as a practical matter, have we seen certain school districts almost band together to designate a bunch of these books as sensitive material and thereby implicitly take over as a practical matter what the other schools in the state can put on their shelves?
Yeah, we've absolutely seen that. We've seen that here in Utah. We've seen that around the country. We've seen coordinated efforts to get certain individuals on school district boards or library review boards to make sure that they're getting the type of decisions they want. You know, and that's really concerning. And that's also, you know, the same individuals that are driving this, the book banning in these districts more aggressively are the same individuals that were the driving force behind this law in the first place. And just to, you know, kind of provide some context, you know, the proffered justification for why we needed this law is this illusory idea that there was all this pornography and indecent materials on school library shelves. That wasn't the case. No one disputes that pornography, obscene materials should be excluded from school libraries. But prior to the book removal law, Utah's law forbade the distribution of obscene or pornographic materials to minors for decades. So this is nothing new. At the same time, each school district already had in place policies and procedures to ensure that every book on their shelf could be challenged, could be reviewed, and then could be removed and banned if they determined that it did not have value as a whole, which is what's required by the First Amendment. And so all of these functions that were in place, everything that's constitutionally permissible for how schools can screen material from their library was already functioning in Utah's library. And so by design, the book removal law attempted to go further. It goes further so that it can censor material that has constitutional protection, but might not be, you know, fall under the types of approved material that certain legislators think Utah's children should be reading.
So let's talk about who the plaintiffs are so we can understand. Let's get into a little bit of the mechanics of the lawsuit. What are the categories of plaintiffs?
Yeah.
And defendants.
Absolutely. And so here, in this case, we have 3 categories of plaintiffs. And so they represent really the whole spectrum of the First Amendment rights at issue. We have the estate of Kurt Vonnegut. Kurt Vonnegut was a World War II veteran who wrote Slaughterhouse-Five, which is one of largely considered the most influential anti-war novels of the past generation. And so Slaughterhouse-Five is a semi-autobiographical novel based on his experience as a prisoner of war during World War II and experience a Dresden firebombing. You know, and it's a plea to his fellow humans to say, hey, you know, war is horrible. Think twice before you put yourself in the type of situation that I did. You know, so why Utah schools or Utah's legislatures feel the need to remove that from the library shelves, you know, is beyond me.
Why was that one removed? What was the criteria for that one?
The per se ban.
The per se ban, know, because it mentioned sexual activity
at
some point.
I haven't gotten to the point where I've been able to determine which school district found, you know, in what specific sense, but I've read Slaughterhouse-Five several times, and it's still, you know, a question to me.
Right.
And then we, you know, also have author plaintiffs, three other New York Times bestselling and award-winning authors, Alana K. Arnold, Ellen Hopkins, and Amy Reed, and then two anonymous student plaintiffs. And just to give you a sense of the different rights at issues here, just as the First Amendment protects the freedom to speak, it also protects the freedom to receive information and ideas. And so our author plaintiffs, they have a constitutional right to reach their intended audiences with their protected information, ideas, and lived experiences, and they have the right to do so without unreasonable interference from the state, and without the state unjustly labeling their works pornography or indecent materials. At the same time, Utah's students have a right to access diverse and valuable bodies of information free from unreasonable censorship. Here, that the per se ban and the statewide ban prevent Utah's students from being able to access a huge chunk of that material. And so those are both of the rights at issue.
Okay, so you sort of started to anticipate my next question, which is the legal theories. Just briefly talk to us, flesh out the legal theories a little more, and tell us about these other precedents that, you know, you think might drive a pathway to success.
Yeah, absolutely. And so First Amendment jurisprudence and case law is complex, and it's complicated. And so there is some fractured and, you know, a little bit weaker case law around the individual bannings of book that largely stems from a Supreme Court case, PICO v. Board of Island Trust. And so in that case, Slaughterhouse-Five was also removed, and a number of books, I believe it was 13, removed by an individual school district, based not on the value that they had, but based on the school board's disapproval with the message within them. And so the Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional censorship. Cases like that have similarly been brought around the country, but there's been no real clear legal framework that has been established. What our case does is it advances what's called a non-public forum argument. And so public forums, limited public forums, and non-public forums, you know, are government spaces where the First Amendment applies. And so that framework and the what's called standards of scrutiny in a non-public forum analysis are well established and well documented. And so as we were following cases around the country, mainly Penguin Random House's cases, we saw that they were having success with that type of argument. And so especially in cases like ours, where you have a very extreme law that sweeps up so much constitutionally protected speech, it's not just one decision that's being made for the wrong reasons. And so that non-public forum analysis, it requires that the conduct or the regulation of speech in that forum must be reasonably related to the purpose of the forum. And so our forum here is school libraries. School libraries are places of self-directed learning that are integral to a student's education and development. They're one of the few places that students can go with trusted educators or teachers to learn about things that aren't covered in their prescribed curriculum, things that might relate to them personally, spark their curiosity, or those around them. And so the non-public forum analysis asks whether this law is reasonable in light of the purpose of school libraries. And it would be reasonable if it functioned to remove pornography and other materials like that. But because they never really were in these school libraries, and there was already laws, policies, and procedures in place to ensure everything that was regulated was regulated, was already there, this law only effect is to go further than the Constitution allows. That is unconstitutional in a non-public forum analysis, and would constitute this law being overbroad in violation of the First Amendment.
Has Penguin Random House, have they succeeded at any appellate level, or are the only decisions you're getting at the district court level?
You know, and so success is a very layered question here. They, I believe, are going to be back in front of the Eighth Circuit in Iowa next week. And so What happened in that case is they achieved a preliminary injunction, you know, right off the bat. And the court said that they found that they had a likelihood of success on the merits, and it enjoined the law without making a final decision. The state of Iowa appealed that and went before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit found that the district court didn't apply the proper preliminary injunction framework. And so they then stayed the injunction, sent it back down to Iowa, the district court. They had another preliminary injunction motion and hearing. The court, district court, stayed that in the law again, and so now they're back in front of the Eighth Circuit on the second appeal. The case in Florida, which is Penguin Random House v. Gibson, that case they were successful at the district court in seeking a permanent injunction declaratory judgment that the law is unconstitutional, and that is being appealed in that circuit.
And what do you anticipate in terms of the timeline of this litigation? Do you anticipate seeking injunctive relief, or do you expect this will just play out as a normal litigation, or do you not know yet?
Yeah, I mean, and so constitutional cases like this are, you know, rarely normal litigation, and just in the way they progress in their timelines. We are not planning to move for preliminary relief at this time, and that's largely because of the amount of time that's passed since the law has been in effect. And so we're moving directly for what's called a permanent injunction. We intend to seek that relief and provide that briefing and have a court make a decision as quickly as possible. Those timelines aren't always easy to predict, but we would like to have those materials submitted before the court pending a decision within 6 months or so.
Okay, Tom Ford from the ACLU, anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I just appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, the Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Here to tell us what happened is Councilmember Ed Parisian. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Roger.
And welcome to the new year and the second half of the Ed Parisian term.
Yeah, baby.
All right.
Through the first half.
It's halftime. And we're going to come back. I want to come back and talk about what you learned, what was surprising at the end of the interview. But let's start by talking about last night. The Recreate 248 project was on the agenda. Yeah. What was discussed?
Well, we've narrowed it down to three concepts, right? Side running lanes, middle running bus lanes, and middle running light rail. And they want us to choose a LPA, locally preferred alternative. So we kind of balked at that at this stage. Just because I think the general consensus was it ties us into something that we don't know. There wasn't enough information to determine. There's some land taking involved, yeah, and big wide lanes, and it just wasn't clear enough to say, yeah, let's go down this route, as it were, pun intended.
Okay, so as a practical matter, and because it's a state road,
yeah,
it's sort of like a dance that you have to do with UDOT, right? You have to say, this is what we want, and then it moves into their consideration. Have I got that right?
Right.
Okay.
And that, I think that's what we're afraid of,
mm-hmm,
of saying what we really wanted without knowing what we really wanted or what could happen, what was feasible. And once you go down that road and you pick an LPA, just like they did for 224, you kind of, it gets set in stone.
So what do you need to learn? Yeah. What going forward, what do you need to do to get comfortable to be able to pick an option?
Well, for me, I want to know what kind of land's going to be taken. Yeah. I was talking about the Alberto's, where Alberto's is there on the corner of Bonanza and Kearns. That whole building might be taken. It wasn't clear. That was
okay,
the problem.
So in order to do the widened bus lane, you'd probably have to take some land on the, as you're going out of town, on the right side, which is where Alberto's is.
Yeah.
And wouldn't there also have to be some land taken on the left side, which is where PC Hill is?
It depends. Like on 224, they shifted everything over. So they're only taking land or using land on one side, the east side. So they're going to shift everything over. So that could be, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to choose an LPA if I don't know what's going on.
Well, that's fair. So let's talk about what has to happen to get you the information that you need. Going forward.
We kind of gave them direction. So the idea was like, all right, they don't have the staff time to fully vet all three.
Okay.
So we're like, all right, how about you vet the side running lanes?
And it's a practical matter. I suspect that's where you're going to end up, but you just need to know that it makes sense.
Kind of, right. Exactly.
Of course, doing something like a train is just a massive financial issue.
Yeah, it's expensive.
And would that be, whose money would that be? Would that be UDOT money?
It's not going to be our money.
Right, I don't think you have enough money for it. Right. I don't know what a train running down the middle of, of 248 would cost, but it would be a lot.
Expensive. So I asked the question, like, well, if we do the bus down the middle, can we do the train down the middle later? If it all works out and it seems like that's a good thing, they said, yeah.
Okay, so you're asking them to help you come to a decision by the end of January?
I'm not putting any timelines on them. These things take time, and I'm not going to rush it just to say we did something and have it now be wrong. So, that's kind of, we can talk about that later, but that's where I don't like to do stuff. I don't know what.
Well, it makes perfect sense. You want to know what you're voting for. Right. I mean, that people put you there, and expect you to do that. That's it on 248. Anything else on 248?
That's where we wound up. They're going to come back. They want an LPA resolution next council meeting. I'm like, I don't think so.
My understanding was that there was some indication that they wanted to decide by January 20th. You're not there yet.
No, okay. I don't think any of us are.
Okay. I want to talk about Bonanza Flat.
Let's.
Because, Bonanza Flat, I like it when we have a story that I think was a success. And my sense, and I want to hear your view, is that Bonanza Flat has been a success.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It's great. I mean, we preserved. I mean, the idea was to protect the outskirts from development. I mean, that would have been a golf course, a convention center, hotels. I mean, it was all in the cards. So, the purchase itself was a great idea. Now it's just kind of some fine-tuning of it, but Utah Bonanza is on it.
Among other things, I understand you heard about some owls that were rescued.
Oh, yeah.
A whodunit, so to speak.
The fluxinated owl or something.
Yeah,
there's like three of them.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of cool.
And a lot of trail restoration.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit, and I think this is an issue that you're interested in, which is the way that transportation has been organized to get people up there without parking.
Right.
How has that worked?
Well, I've taken the purple bus a couple times. It's kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to drive up. They drive you. You have your bike with you or not. And to me, it's kind of a no-brainer. I mean, I'm a bus guy anyway, so I think it's a great thing. I mean, if you're really pressed for time, maybe you can drive up there and be fine, but I think it's a good, how it's working.
And my understanding is that one of the reasons that the people think this was a success was that parking has been substantially reduced up there, which I guess people are taking the purple bus. I understand that you had a question about people going off trail. Is that a problem up there?
Well, it's not that they're going off trail. There's been trails.
They're making their own trails?
Social trails. They've been there for years.
Okay.
Some of them. People that live up there have little shortcuts and, take a little trail to your neighbor and this and that. So there's crisscross with all these little social trails. And it's creating a little, getting confrontational at points. Yeah, so I like everyone to get along and hug and whatnot, and they're not. So some fine-tuning needs to be
So what do you do about that? I mean, do you have enforcement? How do you try to stop? Do you put little gates up there and say, don't go this way? So, the way around America, they have these little barriers that say, don't take your dog here, this is not a real trail.
Well, they have gates, but people are cutting the locks.
They're cutting the locks?
I remember from Heinrich days was telling me about that. And so it's kind of a little push and pull going on up there. And I don't think enforcement is the key. It's more on just coming to meeting everybody, just talk.
Yeah.
What do you really need?
And I understand there have been complaints. Wendy Fisher indicated that some of her people are actually getting harassed up there.
Yeah, and that's not cool.
No.
I mean, they're not trained professionals.
Conflict resolution.
Right. It's like, that's not the way it should be.
Yeah.
So we need to come to a conclusion there and, settle everybody down.
I understand you also heard a presentation about the Arts and Culture District, Arts and Culture Master Program.
Master Plan.
It's like 100 pages. What?
122.
Did you read them all in?
I read every one of them.
And what? Give us the gist. What is it tell you?
It's great. I mean, it's just trying to get something on paper, right? Mm-hmm. Where are we going to go? There's no, like, big details in it, which I thought was great because it leaves it up to the flow and see where we come. But it's got some, had some good milestones, near-term, mid-term, long-term things. You know, the arts are great. I mean, I love arts and culture and all those things. So,
so basically, there's a report that talked about how to incentivize, how do you create a, right. a culture that encourages it.
Basically. Yeah,
that culture. Basically got it right.
Right, and it could be, you know, as we saw in December when we didn't have any snow, it's like, oh, are we a one-trick pony town? But I've always thought we shouldn't be. So there's a lot of work we need to do to integrate something else, let's call it, into town.
And something interesting that you haven't done before is pick a council candidate.
I haven't. I've been on the other side of it.
Did you interview for
I've applied for Andy's spot in 2017 and Nan's spot in 2021. Sandwiched around running for council in 2019 and 2023, so I haven't been on this end of it.
What are you looking for? What is Ed's perspective on selecting a council candidate?
I'm looking for pragmatic, thoughtful, body of work. What have you done? Where are you coming from? What do you want to do? Something that'll gel. It's hard to say, you know, until you meet people and talk to them and ask them questions. It's a tough decision.
Have you met many of the candidates at this point?
I probably know most of them.
I think
through,
so, yeah.
You know, being here. I'm psyched. We got 10, seems like pretty solid people. I'm sure one of them's going to make a great counselor.
Now, well, you can choose not to answer this question, but I'm curious. Have you been approached directly by any of these candidates who tried to lobby you yet?
No, I have not been.
That's interesting.
Right.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have been surprised if the answer was yes, but I'm also not surprised that the answer is no.
I know, right? Yeah. I thought I might be, but no, they know. I'm not going to go there.
Okay. Ed, we got just about a minute or two left. We started off at this interview by talking about how you're 2 years in.
I am.
Okay. Halftime. Yeah. What has been the most surprising thing about your first 2 years?
Surprising?
Yeah. What surprised you?
I guess how deeply passionate people can be about certain things. I mean, I'm a compromiser, I think, and some people don't wanna. And, you know, it's hard to make everybody happy. I guess the most surprising thing, I guess, bottom line is, I really thought I could make everybody happy. I know, naive, but it turns out I can't.
No. So, I'm not surprised by that.
Well, you should have told me.
I wish I had. What do you like best? That. What do you like best about the job?
I love best about leaving, doing something good for people, like a legacy of good. For instance, something that's not a big thing, but it is a big thing in my head, is we limited the height in Bonanza Park. Some people wanted 5-6 stories, and we said, you know, three of us, it was a 3-2 vote. We voted three times on it. Three stories with an option of four. And I feel like that, to me, is like a permanent kind of
legacy
that I can help, you know. And that's something that the people, it was clearly a majority of people didn't want the big height. And I feel good that I was able to come through with that, you know.
15 seconds. What's been the hardest thing?
Getting up in the morning to come see you at 8:30.
Well, Ed, I've appreciated our visits, and I look forward to doing them again over the next 2 years.
I love it.
And sooner or later, I'm going to ask you if you're going to run again. Ed, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You bet, Raj.
We'll be right back after this. Flu season is very much upon us. On the phone to talk about what's going on around the state with respect to flu and other contagious diseases is Dr. Alicia Nolan, the state epidemiologist. Good morning, Dr. Nolan. Thanks for spending time with us.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Dr. Nolan, before we get into the substance, can you share a bit about your role as the state epidemiologist? What is that job?
So really, it's the person who's in charge of looking at the data for the Department of Health and Human Services and trying to understand what it all means. What do those trends mean? Who's getting sick? Who's doing well? And what we can do to change it.
And I guess that allows you to look at all kinds of different data, you know, hospital admissions. Do you look at things like wastewater data as well?
Yeah, we do. We are monitoring wastewater data here in Utah for a number of infectious diseases. And it's really helpful because it tells us stuff that people are sick for that they might not be going into the doctor's office for.
And just so we can get a sense of it, what's the career path that leads you into a job like this?
Well, actually, epidemiologists come from all different angles. You can do it as a specific degree where you go and do an MPH or a PhD in epidemiology. We have people who are veterinarians. We have people who are nurses. I happen to come from a medical angle. I was a pediatrician. I actually also did a PhD. And so I had both the training as a doctor, but also as somebody who is used to looking at a lot of data.
Well, I like you really like data, so I want to talk about some of that now. Before we do that, though, I know we're in what is known as flu season. What months are typically considered part of the flu season?
So really, we tend to see it between October and November to March or April. We are in the typical height of it, and we are seeing that happening this year.
And do we typically see cases outside of those months as well, or is it really, if you were, as a data person, drawing me a normal curve, would I see a big peak during this period and then sort of small tails on both sides?
Yeah, that's right. We do get sporadic cases kind of all year round, but now is when we see most people get it. Those people who get it in the summer or other times of year, goodness, they're unlucky, but it does happen.
So what are you observing with respect to this year's flu season, both in terms of incidence and severity?
Yeah, we are definitely getting hit pretty hard right now. And we sort of expected that when we looked at the rest of the country and, in fact, the rest of the world. We got a hint of what was coming at us, and unfortunately, it is now here. We are seeing quite a few people go into their doctor's office with flu symptoms. But worryingly, we're seeing a lot of people get hospitalized. We're actually quite high this year, higher than we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years, the number of people who've had to be hospitalized for flu.
And what typically is the profile of someone who ends up hospitalized? Is it all ages? Does it tend to be elderly? What does it look like? And what typically happens to someone who's hospitalized with flu?
Yeah. Well, certainly the people at the highest risk are the people at the littlest ages and the biggest ages.
Okay.
So we definitely see people who are babies. We're always super concerned by babies getting sick with the flu. They have a hard time. Their bodies aren't quite mature enough to fight it off, and they can get really sick. And then it's the older people, right? Their bodies are on the other end of the spectrum. They are sort of getting a little less good at fighting off infections, and they can get really sick. But we do see some people in the middle, too. So it's not a clear, like, you don't need to worry if you're not in one of those two age groups. But certainly if you're older or younger, that's who you're really concerned for.
What is the nature of the illness that causes someone to need to be hospitalized? What kind of symptoms or conditions are they presenting with?
Yeah, I mean, the classic flu is the achy, high fever, cough, just feeling pretty terrible. The people who get hospitalized, usually it's breathing problems. They just can't breathe well enough and get enough oxygen into their body. And so they're having to go into the hospital to get some oxygen, to get some breathing support.
Okay, so it's more that than dehydration or fluids. It's more oxygen related typically.
Typically, but you're right. You have a good point. Some people do have a hard time keeping down fluids. They can't drink enough. Their fevers are so high, they just feel terrible, right? And so they do have a hard time keeping down fluids. So that one is also an option. You're right, that people might need an IV to get some more fluids in their body.
Now you mentioned a minute ago something to the effect of we might have seen it coming. Do you see a pattern where what happens in the southern hemisphere sort of gives you a clue as to what we might see? Is that how what you meant by we might see it coming?
We do often look at the southern hemisphere and get a prediction of what's coming here, but it ain't perfect. unfortunately, we wish it was. What I was referring to is actually we saw a number of other countries, even in the northern hemisphere, get this earlier than we did. Japan and England, they both saw it pretty early, and it certainly swept through their populations pretty significantly. So we were just waiting for it to come over here.
Mm-hmm. And how effective is, we talked about hospitalizations, how effective is this year's flu vaccine, particularly with respect to hoping to prevent hospitalizations?
So the flu vaccine is always hard because we have to guess what it's going to be before it gets here, right? You have to pick the right virus to target. And flu is really, really good at switching around exactly what kind of virus is circulating. This year is an okay match. We do have some preliminary data from England suggesting that it actually has a pretty good ability to decrease hospitalizations. Specifically, they found a good effect in their kids and then a reasonable effect in their adults. So there is definitely an impact. So I don't know about you, but I'd like anything to decrease my risk of going to the hospital.
I guess you don't have data yet on whether there's any sort of noticeable correlation between the hospitalizations we're seeing here in Utah and whether or not those people were vaccinated.
No, unfortunately, we don't have that data well enough and that fast, but so we can't say here in Utah, but mm-hmm. other places, a hint that the match is enough to be able to help the body fight it off some.
Now, I don't think that you're one of those people in the lab coats who's trying to cook up the formula for the vaccine, but talk to us a little bit. You mentioned that it's a target. How do they try to guess at what to shoot at, for lack of a better term, when they're trying to come up with this year's vaccine?
So it's the World Health Organization. It's a grouping of countries all come together twice a year and look at what's circulating at that point and then try to predict what's going to be happening about 6 to 8 months later, because that's how long it takes to get a vaccine ready. In February, they look at what's happening down in the southern hemisphere. They can mm-hmm. see what virus is circulating there, and then they use that to make the vaccine for the northern hemisphere. And the same in like around September, they look at what's happening here and make the vaccine for the southern hemisphere.
So it's almost like they map the characteristics of the virus and try to put that, from a layman's understanding, we're trying to map the virus and put that into the shot, right, essentially?
Yeah, we're trying to figure out, like, hey, this is the one that's happening. We have to sort of predict where it might go evolutionarily and genetically in about 8 months when it will come actually to us. So it's a little bit of math, it's a little bit of science, and it's a little bit of guess.
Fascinating. Is it too late if one of our listeners is listening to this and hearing these dire statistics about this high rate of hospitalization, is it too late to get a flu shot?
No, it isn't. You can still get a flu shot. It does take a little bit of time to get your body really trained. That's what vaccines do, right? They train your body to fight off whatever infection it is. So it takes a little while. So we encourage you to get it as soon as you can, but it's still time to do it. If you haven't had the flu yet, hey, you can still get that shot and help yourself not get it for the next few months.
Okay. Anything else you want to touch on with respect to flu?
No, I really encourage people, if they're feeling sick, if they're not doing well, stay home. Don't get the rest of us sick. Unfortunately, I think it's going around.
I want to ask you about measles. Where do we stand in terms of measles cases here in Utah?
Yeah, we are at a record high. We haven't had this many measles cases in Utah for over 50 years, which is really concerning. We've had 176 people diagnosed with measles since the beginning of the outbreak last summer. So really, it continues to expand. We are continuing to see people diagnosed. And unfortunately, it's through many different parts of the state, which means many different people are at risk.
Are we seeing concentrations around particular schools? I mean, I imagine part of the data you look at is spread patterns. Go ahead. Are you seeing it in, you said it's in many places, but are you seeing little concentrations?
Yeah, it is. It is, as probably most of your listeners know, the outbreak of measles in Utah really has been concentrated in southwest Utah. And that's where we continue to see most people get infected. And most of the people we can see who are sick with measles up in other parts of the state link somehow back to that area. So is it they went to visit family or there was somebody who came and exposed them at an event? Most of the times we can see that. So it continues to mostly be linked there, but we are now seeing sometimes where we can't figure it out exactly how they got it, and it was somewhere they were exposed more up in other parts of the state.
And you mentioned that it's the highest we've seen in something like 50 years. I guess that's presumably since the widespread availability of the measles vaccine. Are you seeing a correlation between those who are getting it and the lack of a vaccination?
Yes, most certainly. And I think that's something important to recognize. We talk about measles and how many cases we're having, but the truth is the vast majority of Utahns don't have much to worry about. We understand more than 90% of Utahns are vaccinated against measles. And the measles vaccine, while it's not perfect, because what is, it's really close. So it means if you've been vaccinated, your risk is exceptionally low. So here in Utah, we are seeing the vast, vast majority of people who are getting sick are those people who have not been vaccinated. We do occasionally see somebody get measles even when they've had the vaccine, but that just really indicates how many people are being exposed to this. It's just most people in the body are able to fight it off, but a few people, even with that vaccine, somehow it sneaks through.
Dr. Luna, another thing I've heard, at least anecdotally here in Summit County, is incidence of GI viruses. you know, sort of 24-hour bugs, possibly norovirus. Is that something you're seeing on a larger basis statewide?
We do see it. We actually don't have as thorough data about that. We track our flu and measles and those kind of cases really closely. Yeah. Norovirus, we don't get as good data, but we have been hearing about clusters of them at schools, at different daycare centers where you do see people getting sick with norovirus or other GI illnesses like that.
And before we go, can you just talk a little bit about the kind of advice you would give for people who want to stay healthy throughout the year in general? What should people be doing?
Well, one of the ones is like what your mom always said, wash your hands. be good about that. Make sure you take those simple precautions. Simple precautions are actually really impressively effective. And then certainly, if you have the option to get vaccinated, like it's something to talk about with your doctor. Vaccines are a really great protection, and we really encourage people to consider those if they have not already been vaccinated so that they can have as much protection as they can.
Anything else you want to add before we go?
No, I hope everybody has a healthy new year.
Dr. Alicia Nolan, the Utah State Epidemiologist, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, have a wonderful day.